for an abbreviated version of Democracy Now that's coming up, followed by Counterspin. And before we go into the next program, I just wanted to talk about what to expect on Tuesday morning at 11 a.m. And I'm just going to read this. What chemicals are lurking in your home or apartment? Tuesday morning on Green Street, Patty and Doug Wood will be offering a one-on-one consultation with anyone who wants to create a healthy place to live. Whether it's questions about water filters or laundry detergents, what kind of paint to buy, or where to get organic carpeting, or what kinds of chemicals are in personal care products you use every day. That's what to expect next week. I meant tomorrow at Tuesday at 11 a.m. for Green Street. Okay? It is 1 minute past 6 p.m. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up. A truncated version of Democracy Now! Stay tuned. Oh, yeah. WBAI New York, WBAI.org.
Democracy Now!
Look, the houses are collapsing and water is standing here. It has been raining for a week to 10 days. You can see there my house has collapsed. A total loss, and I could not save anything from it.
A climate catastrophe. Pakistan has declared a national emergency after historic floods kill more than 1,000 people and leave 30 million displaced. We'll go to Pakistan for the latest and look at how the climate emergency is wreaking havoc across the globe, from China to Jackson, Mississippi. All that and more coming up. To Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Pakistan has declared a national emergency as massive floods continue to devastate the country. At least 119 people died just over the weekend, bringing the death toll to over 1,000 since June. More than 33 million people have been displaced. Pakistan's top climate official described the flooding as a, quote, serious climate catastrophe. Floods have swept away homes, roads, and bridges across Pakistan, where some regions have received 600% more rain than usual. This is Pakistan's Prime Minister, Shahbaz Sharif.
When the plane was landing just now, I looked down with great concentration. It looked like the angry waves of the River Indus had spread across the whole region. The flood of 2010 was a very huge flood in our history, but I feel that this flood has caused much greater havoc. There is extreme devastation all around. More than 900 people have died.
We'll go to Pakistan later in the broadcast. In Mississippi, Governor Tate Reeves has declared a state of emergency after torrential rains are causing the Pearl River to overflow its banks, causing massive flooding. In Mississippi's capital city, Jackson, Mayor Chokwe Antar-Lumumba on Sunday urged residents in flood zones to pack enough supplies to last for days and to evacuate.
If you are capable of getting out now, get out now. Get out as soon as possible.
Today, the Pearl River is expected to crest at nearly 36 feet, 10 feet higher than what's normally considered a flood stage. The Justice Department has released a redacted version of the affidavit the FBI used to get a search warrant for former President Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate. The affidavit revealed authorities were concerned Trump still had possession of top secret documents that could have compromised U.S. intelligence sources and methods. It also revealed the National Archives had recovered 184 classified documents at Mar-a-Lago in January. 25 of those documents were marked top secret. Some included information intercepted under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. The affidavit went on to state, quote, there is also probable cause to believe that evidence of obstruction will be found, unquote. In related news, a federal judge in Florida who was appointed by Trump has indicated she will agree to his request to authorize a special master to review the documents seized by the FBI. In Ukraine, Russian and Ukrainian forces continue to trade heavy fire around the Russian-occupied Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, raising fears of a major radiation disaster. Over the weekend, Ukraine accused Russia of using positions near the plant's 6 nuclear reactors to stage artillery attacks on nearby Ukrainian towns. Meanwhile, Russia's defense ministry says it shot down a Ukrainian drone near the Zaporizhzhia plant's nuclear waste enclosure. Russia also accused Ukraine of shelling the site several times, which Ukrainian officials deny. Officials have started handing out iodine tablets to some 400,000 people living near the plant to help protect them from a potential radioactive release. This comes as the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency says a team of experts is on the way to Zaporizhzhia and will arrive later this week to evaluate the safety and security of Europe's largest nuclear power station. At the United Nations, a month-long meeting to review the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty has ended in failure after Russia objected to a joint statement from 151 nations because it included a paragraph about its occupation of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant in Ukraine. In Libya, at least 32 people died and 159 people were wounded Saturday as rival militias fought in Tripoli. It was the heaviest fighting seen in Libya's capital in 2 years. The dead included at least 17 civilians. Libya has been in a state of crisis for over a decade after NATO helped rebels topple the government of Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. Since February, Libya has had two prime ministers competing for power. Saturday's fighting was between militias with ties to each of the men. The Environmental Protection Agency has moved to reclassify two commonly used chemicals as hazardous substances after a growing body of scientific research linked them to cancer and other health problems. On Friday, the EPA said its move to reclassify PFAS under the federal Superfund law could accelerate cleanup efforts at hundreds of toxic sites across the United States. PFAS are often called forever chemicals because they can take centuries to break down in the environment. They're used in everything from food packaging and cookware to cosmetics, fabrics, and firefighting foam. In humans, PFAS have been linked to a host of dangerous health effects, including liver damage, decreased fertility, asthma, thyroid disease, low infant birth weight, and cancer. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell has warned efforts to control inflation will bring pain to many households. Powell spoke in Jackson Hole, Wyoming on Friday.
Reducing inflation is likely to require a sustained period of below-trend growth. Moreover, there will very likely be some softening of labor market conditions. While higher interest rates, slower growth, and softer labor market conditions will bring down inflation, they will also bring some pain to households and businesses. These are the unfortunate costs of reducing inflation. But a failure to restore price stability would mean far greater pain.
Progressives, including Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren and former Labor Secretary Robert Reich, have warned Powell's moves will lead the United States into a recession. Reich said, quote, the pain is already being felt across the land. Most Americans aren't getting inflation-adjusted wage increases, which means they're becoming poorer. In New Mexico, a 23-year-old asylum seeker from Brazil has died by suicide while in custody of Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Kesley Vile was being indefinitely detained at the Troubled Torrance Detention Center as he awaited his deportation to Brazil. The American Civil Liberties Union said his death was the, quote, result of abhorrent conditions and treatment by ICE and Torrance staff. Torrance is managed by the private prison corporation CoreCivic. Last year, it failed its annual government inspection due to chronic understaffing and unsanitary and unsafe conditions. In Ethiopia, at least 7 people were killed Friday, including several children, when government forces attacked a kindergarten in the northern Tigray region. The attack in Tigray's regional capital, Mekele, came as a 5-month truce between Ethiopia's military and separatist rebels unraveled, threatening to worsen a humanitarian crisis that's already among the worst in the world. The UN says the fighting has left about half of Tigray's 6 million residents on the brink of famine. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Pakistan has declared a national emergency as massive floods continue to devastate the country. At least 119 people died over the weekend, bringing the death toll to over 1,000 since June. More than 33 million people have been displaced. Pakistan's top climate official described the flooding as a, quote, serious climate catastrophe. Floods have swept away homes, roads, and bridges across Pakistan, where some regions have received 600% more rain than usual. Survivors say they've lost everything in the floods.
There is no administration here. The deputy commissioner is doing nothing. Look, the houses are collapsing and water is standing here. It has been raining for a week to 10 days. You can see there, my house has collapsed. A total loss, and I could not save anything from it.
Pakistan's foreign minister, Bawali Bhutto Zardari, has called on international support to help Pakistan recover from the floods.
They're absolutely devastating. I haven't seen any destruction or devastation of this scale. I find it very difficult to put into words the phraseologies that we're used to, whether it's monsoon rains or flooding, doesn't quite seem to encapsulate the ongoing devastation and disaster that we're still witnessing. The fact that Pakistan contributes negligible amounts to the overall carbon footprint, but we are devastated by climate disasters such as these time and time again, and we have to adapt within our limited resources and whatever way we can to live in this new environment.
The floods come as the climate emergency continues to wreak havoc across the globe. Europe's confronting its worst drought in 500 years. China's facing an unprecedented heat wave that's dried up rivers and lakes. Here in the United States, the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, urged residents Sunday night to evacuate the city as it braces for more flooding. We're joined now by 2 guests. In London, Asad Rehman is with us, executive director of War on Want, lead spokesperson for the Climate Justice Coalition. And joining us from Islamabad, Pakistan, by phone is Shamir Baloch. He covers Pakistan for The Guardian. His new piece is titled, People Are Getting Sick, Destitution in Flood-Hit Pakistan. Shamir Baloch, thank you so much for joining us. Can you just describe what's happening in your country?
Yeah, actually, things are getting worse with each passing day. And we know, and the Prime Minister of Pakistan is already mentioned it, like the half of Pakistan, more than half of Pakistan and 4 corners of the Pakistan are underwater. Like there is already international call for, Pakistan is called for international help. And from Baluchistan to Sindh province to Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces, they all are underwater. And it's quite a climate catastrophe. And Pakistan is suffering so much, and people like in far-flung areas, people are the state and the government machineries, they're trying their best to help and reach out, but they have lost access to many parts of Pakistan, like in Baluchistan, which covers half of Pakistan, like the road, rail, and the bridges have been wiped out from this flash flood. And the only ways to reach out those displaced people and the affected people is through helicopters, and the army has been called on in entire Pakistan for help. But again, Pakistan has been going through an economic crisis for the last couple of months, and it makes it harder for Pakistan to go for relief and rescue operations across the country. Apart from that, the worst we have seen right now in a couple of weeks. Pakistan is already going through a political crisis. After since April, when Imran Khan was ousted from power through a constitutional mean, like oath of no confidence. Since then, he has been taking on the military and the West and the government, like for the current government, for orchestrating and conspiring against his government. So now he has taken on the government, and so it's quite very hard.
Can you talk about the connection between the flooding and climate change?
Actually, it's quite clear. We have seen in Pakistan in May, I already did a story on it about the heat waves in Pakistan. It was the very worst heat waves in May. Just imagine, in May, more than 50 degrees Celsius was recorded. And in mid-June, at the end of the June, then we had abnormal monsoon. And that have just been going on with some intervals. In August, it's a climate crisis. In August, we have seen a snowfall in Ziyarat, a town which is around not more than 100 kilometers away from Baluchistan's provincial capital. Just seeing snowfall and heat waves in May and snowfall in August and abnormal monsoon, these all are the climate crisis and climate catastrophe. And there's already a debate in Pakistan, like Pakistan doesn't like contribute more than 1% to carbon emission, and it's in the receiving end of this climate crisis.
I want to turn to some of the voices of more survivors in the floods in Pakistan.
We are very worried. Our elders are saying they have not seen such rains and floods in the past 30 to 35 years. This is the first time we have seen such heavy rains. Now we are concerned that, God forbid, this type of heavy rain may continue in the future because the weather pattern is changing. So we are now really nervous about this. We are really worried.
The rain destroyed my house. My livestock were all lost. My fields devastated. Only our lives were saved. Nothing else is left. Thank God. He saved the lives of my children. Now we are at Allah's mercy.
My property, my house, everything was flooded. So we took shelter on the roof of a government school for 3 days and three nights. Around 200 people with kids. We sat on the roof for 3 days. When the water receded a little, we dragged the kids out of the mud and walked for 2 days until we arrived at a safe place.
Voices of survivors. I'm going to put this question to our other guest, Asad Rehman, executive director of War on Want, lead spokesperson for the Climate Justice Coalition, because it's such a critical one. And it's not only about Pakistan, but it's about who contributes the most to the climate catastrophe and who feels the effects of it the most. This is not only in Pakistan, but around the world, and what global responsibility actually means. Asad.
Good afternoon, Amy, or good morning there. Well, I mean, first of all, as we heard from Shamir, you know, the scale of the devastation that's affected Pakistan is incredible. And we often look at these catastrophes in isolation. If we cast our minds back, we could be talking about heat waves and floods in Pakistan in 2010, 11, 12, 14, 15. It's going literally every single year. And, of course, the earth is out of balance at just over 1 degree warming. And no matter what we do, that is now irreversible. What we can do is, of course, stop it getting much, much worse. And these heat waves and floods that we're seeing playing out all around the world are now between 30 to 100 times more likely because of the climate crisis. And they're happening sooner each year. They're happening in more extreme. And, of course, they're lasting longer. So how do people recover from this never-ending crisis? And when we look at Pakistan, where the World Food Programme already estimates that 70% of Pakistan's population don't have access to proper nutrition. Once again, it's the poorest, those who have done the least, who are seeing their lives and livelihoods being destroyed. And as Samir and yourself said, you know, Pakistan, like many countries in the global south, are responsible for a negligible amount of global emissions, about 1%. But they are stuck in a toxic interplay between a climate catastrophe that they're not responsible for, increasing hunger, structural inequality, and a rigged economic system that has literally left the poor hanging by a thread. And many states absolutely overwhelmed. And, you know, the situation is going to get much, much worse. And, you know, for Pakistan, which is a country where, you know, it has the largest amount of glaciers, that's 7,000 glaciers. As these glaciers begin to melt, these glacial lakes are going to overflow. And it's already estimated that 2/3 of these glaciers will be lost. And whilst today we see floods, when these glaciers are gone, The real question is going to be, where is the fresh water that provides, not just for the people of Pakistan, but for hundreds of millions of people across the Indian subcontinent? Now, when we talk about, you know, the reality of this crisis and the warnings have been given to us, right? The dangers of breaching the 1.5-degree guardrail are going to be critical, that these extreme weather events are going to spiral out of control. And we've told that we have to halve global emissions. So rich countries really need to be cutting their emissions as close to zero by 2030 as possible, so that the rest of the world does have a little bit more space, those who are the least responsible. But currently, we're heading to a warming of just over 2.7 degree at the best. And we've seen rich countries ramping up a massive new wave of fossil fuels from the US to the UK, Canada, Australia to the EU. It's literally a bonanza for fossil fuel companies who, having made $2 trillion in profit over the last three decades, are now openly betting they can make trillions more in profit. This is, as the UN Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty, Philip Alston, said, this is the reality of climate apartheid. The rich are going to use their wealth to try and seek safety and literally leave the poor to burn.
You know, talking about the poorest areas in Pakistan alone, Balochistan has been hit the hardest. It's the largest and most impoverished of the provinces. And I wanted to highlight what U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken tweeted earlier this month. He said, "We stand by Pakistan in hard times and offer our support to flood victims. In addition to $100,000 in immediate relief, the U.S. announced $1 million to build resilience against natural disasters. And we continue to work together to mitigate future impacts of the climate crisis." Your response, Asad Rehman?
It's beyond laughable. It's criminal. Look, the poor in the world are hanging by a thread. And, you know, there was a promise made in 2009, led by the United States, for $100 billion in climate finance. 13 years later, that has not been met. And the scale of what is now needed is estimated in the trillions. Look, rich countries are simply turning their back on the majority of the world. You know, for the US to announce $1 million, for the UK to announce $1.5 million, look, the reality is we're seeing, you know, a climate crisis which is overwhelming the ability of states in the global south to be able to respond. And as I said, it's not just one crisis. It's a crisis of acute hunger. It's a crisis of structural inequality, of poverty and injustice. And these are all leading to a situation where the question is for the majority of the people, is life simply going to be possible? And unfortunately, the reality, as we've seen at these climate summits, as we saw in Glasgow last year, and they're likely going to see in Sharm el-Sheikh in the COP in November, is rich countries saying, we will not be liable for the very damages that our economies are causing, and they will turn their backs on the poor.
The Climate Policy Initiative earlier this month releasing that report that showed Africa is getting just 12% of the finance it needs to manage the impact of climate change, which, of course, as we know, it didn't cause. The report noting African countries need $250 billion annually to move to renewable energy and address the effects of climate change. But funding in 2020 was just $29.5 billion. Your response, Asad?
Yeah, it's a drop in the ocean, and increasingly, even the amount of money that is given, you know, is often tied to loans, so it's more debt creating, and we know that many countries in the global south now are overwhelmed by debt. Look, Pakistan, going back to Pakistan, you know, it's estimated that it's about to pay out $6.5 billion in debt repayments over the next 3 years. It's debt is running in the scale of hundreds of billions. We saw what happened in Sri Lanka, where with debt repayments and the government simply telling people not to eat or to eat less food. The reality is, this is a moment of permanent and multiple crisis, all fueling each other and fueling these injustices. What we really need right now is the richest countries in the world to actually live up to their responsibility. Look, there's no shortage of money. We've seen that just looking at the amount of wealth that is extracted from the global south. The fact that the richest billionaires saw their wealth increase by over a trillion dollars just in the last year alone. What we need now is something like a global Green New Deal, a new Marshall Plan, the richest countries to actually provide the finance that is needed to the global south, not only to deal with the climate impacts, but not only to deal with their ability to be able to adapt to this crisis. And of course, that's limited in itself, but also for rich countries to actually cut their emissions. You can't simply keep expanding fossil fuels, and you can't simply watch the rest of the world burn. And, you know, it's not just Pakistan, it's not just China. You know, we're seeing in the Horn of Africa at this very moment, fifth consecutive year of drought, the longest for 40 years. Ethiopia, Kenya, Somalia, estimated up to 15 million people face acute hunger. We're now in the era of climate famines. We either have to stop this and actually begin to address it, or literally we are going to see a world where for the majority of people, life is simply going to be impossible.
And I wanted to ask you about geoengineering. And the whole issue of China deploying cloud-seeding airplanes over drought-stricken parts of the country as hundreds of millions of people endure China's longest heat wave on record. China's Ministry of Water Resources ordering planes to drop silver iodide into the clouds over Hubei province, where prolonged heat has damaged crops and led parts of the Yangtze River to run dry. Assad.
Yeah, what we're seeing in desperate, mad, and simply dangerous experiments with geoengineering. So this basically says, you know, we can carry on polluting, and then somehow we'll find a technological answer to deal with these impacts. There isn't one. We actually don't know what happens if we try and intervene in very, very delicate ecosystems that exist. You know, the humanity's history all around the world over the last few hundred thousand years has been when we've had a stable environment. That environment is no longer stable. So when it's no longer stable, surely the most important thing is to stop fueling the crisis rather than thinking that some technological answer is going to be able to address this. And it's not just China. We're seeing now increasingly with more and more money being poured into sort of idea of techno fixes. And we've seen mad ideas such as putting, you know, mirrors into the atmosphere to deflect the heat of the sun. We've seen mad ideas about pouring more iron filings into the oceans. All of these things. I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, it's beyond like fearful. It's sometimes I'm literally astounded that these ideas have got so much traction, and they are getting traction because people refuse to deal with what is the core of this problem. And the core of the problem is we have a broken energy system dominated by fossil fuel companies, and we have a broken food system dominated by industrial agribusiness. If we stop those two and stop deforestation, we can actually create a world which is not just cleaner and fairer, will cut emissions, but actually allow people to be able to live with dignity.
I want to ask you about part of the IRA, the climate bill that was signed in the United States, the Inflation Reduction Act, about CCS, carbon capture and storage, funded by that bill.
Look, you know, carbon capture and storage is the idea that somehow we can carry on polluting and then we can somehow capture the carbon from fossil fuels and from the industrial processes and bury it into the ground. Now, all the experiments that have ever happened have all shown that there is nothing to the scale of what is needed. The only possible example that may work requires a landmass potentially three times the size of the Indian subcontinent. It's just simply madness. What we're doing is it's like your house being on fire, and then you having a conversation about, well, in the future, what colour should we paint our fire doors? No, the first thing to do is put out the fire. Let's focus on doing that. We know what needs to be done. We can end our addiction to fossil fuels. We can invest in clean, renewable energy, and we can tackle energy poverty. That's what is needed. And unfortunately, this shows the influence of the fossil fuel industry that simply want to continue business as usual and are banking on really risky, dangerous, and frankly, catastrophic policy initiatives that will not deliver the emissions needed within the timescale that we need. We need to cut emissions now, this decade, not there in the future, not try and suck carbon out of the atmosphere in 50 years' time or 70 years' time. We need to act now while we still can.
Finally, I want to ask you, here in Mississippi, in the United States, the capital city, Jackson, Mayor Chokwanta Lumumba urged residents in flood zones to pack enough supplies for days and to evacuate if they can.
I've already received calls from individuals wondering or questioning whether they should get out now. If you are capable of getting out now, get out now. Get out as soon as possible.
So I want to thank you both for being with us. Thank you so much to Asad Raymond. Final words, Asad?
Look, the poor are hanging by a thread, and the richest countries have turned their back.